but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Michael Schill, former University of Oregon president, had moved on to Northwestern. He resigned yesterday. Michael Schill, who was the president of record at Oregon when the Pac-12 had its downfall. In fact, he was on the executive CEO group, the upper echelon of the Pac-12 CEO group. Michael Schill, along with Anna Marie Casse, on that group. He'll resign at Northwestern, and I have to think it's about football. Pat Fitzgerald, the former coach at Northwestern who was fired by Schill, suspended then fired, after an investigation into hazing. Fitzgerald 2 weeks ago reached a settlement with Northwestern. Been a lot of presidential conflict, federal funding, politics. Michael Schill went to Capitol Hill and got grilled over his stance about some protests, pro-Palestinian protests on his campus. He finally has thrown in the keys. Too much pressure. And I have to think it's about his lack of knowledge as it pertains to football. Schill told me once, "I don't know much about football." I stood with him at Stanford Stadium in 2021. Oregon was playing Stanford. Mario Cristobal is about to lose an overtime game to Stanford. And Schill and I stood outside the press box on this platform with this railing. And we had this long conversation about football in general and his job and the campus. And he, at one point, late in the game, I'm looking at the clock. I'm looking at the situation. And I said, Mario Cristobal needs a timeout here. And Schill kind of watched the game, and within seconds, Cristobal came bolting off the sideline, called timeout. It was an obvious timeout situation. And Schill turned to me and he said, "How did you know that Mario Cristobal was going to call a timeout?" And I said, "Well, you're under 2 minutes here. He needed to stop and think about it. It was like a third down. He needed to stop and take a moment and think about the situation. It wasn't necessarily that I, was prescient or I was a fortune teller. It was more that Mario Cristobal was in a situation that deserved and demanded a timeout." And Schill said, "I don't know much about football." Isn't that the biggest sin of a university president these days? To not know much about football? And I can't help but think back to the demise of the Pac-12 conference and Schill being part of that Pac-12 CEO group. He's not alone. All of those presidents, those 12 presidents, should have been taken out to midfield at a football game and pantsed and told, for their roles in killing a conference that was 108 years old. Didn't need to happen. Oregon and Washington, USC, UCLA, they could have found a media deal that would have worked. They could have leveled the ecosystem with the SEC and the Big Ten wanting more and more and more. Michael Schill was in command of his university at Northwestern and certainly in command of his university at Oregon, but he forgot one of the biggest lessons that is available as it pertains to a university ecosystem. The idea that the football coach is the most important and most powerful figure on your campus. Makes more money than the president, makes more money than the AD, holds more clout than the president, holds more clout than the AD. Nobody lining up to take pictures with the university president or the AD. Everybody in line to, well, hey, can I talk to the football coach? Can I get him to play in my golf tournament? The football coach is the draw. The football program is the machine. It prints money. And most universities get that. And it's why you'll see university presidents across the country who will show up at the football game, show up in the news conference for the winning team, Love to be there on the field at the rivalry game when the winning team wins. Love to be present. Love to be pushing the narrative that they are involved and they are ever present. And, you know, even at a school like Oregon State, Jyoti Murthy, who doesn't know a lot about football, I happen to be in her box, in her suite, for the Oregon State home opener last season, Trent Bray's first game as the football coach. With about 5 minutes to go in the game, she says, I have to go to the field. I want to be there when Trent Bray walks off the field. Because she wanted her football coach, she wanted to shake his hand. She wanted to be present. She wanted to be involved and engaged in this nice moment in his career. I think as I look across the country right now at what has happened to college athletics, and, you know, we can talk all we want about, oh, it's off the rails. Oh, it's become too much. Oh, these university presidents, and the notion that Michael Schill, who was candid enough to say, or maybe dumb enough to say, I don't know much about football, that notion ended up with college athletics going in the direction that it went. It has ended up in this place that isn't a happy place. It's not a great place for college sports to be in this position where the ultimate ecosystem for sports is infected by television dollars and is, of course, impacted by the lack of oversight and too slow to share revenue with athletes, of course. And because of that, college campuses now find themselves trying to play catch up with the transfer portal and everything else. We've got a great show for you today. The BFT jury will be here at 4 o'clock. Michael Llewellyn, John Strong, among others. We're going to talk about spitting. You saw it last night in Thursday Night Football. Some spitting going on. Where are we on punishment for spitting in a sporting event? Jalen Carter spits at Dak Prescott. He's ejected in the Thursday night game. Luis Suarez hit with a lengthy ban in the League's Cup for spitting on a Seattle Sounders staff member. What should the punishments be for the spitters? And can you reasonably enforce spitting? It goes back to like a Seinfeld episode. Was there a second spitter? We don't know. Will we have to go to replay eventually to find out who the spitters are? Will there be accusations leveled that aren't accurate? Can you pretend to be spat on if you're an NBA player? Can you flop? We'll talk about spitting with the BFT jurors coming up. I find it repulsing and disgusting, like, you know, the whole idea that you're spitting on a football field, spitting at each other. But athletes will tell you it happens out on the field. We're also going to talk about Mike Gundy's comments. We'll put it to rest this week. He made those comments about resources earlier in the week. Gundy talking on his coach's show on Monday night. He opened a can of worms. Probably shouldn't have. Like, I put this in the category of let sleeping dogs lie. But Mike Gundy coming out and basically saying, you know, Oregon's got way more money. Oregon's got all this NIL money. They're stacking it up over there. They spent $40 million on their roster. And Dan Lanning firing back and then Gundy having to come back later in the week and clarify his comments.
You know, little bit of that was taken out of context. You know, the truth of the matter, Rick, is I was being very complimentary of Oregon and their commitment. The other things that had been said that day were that they've made a huge commitment to facilities, as we know. They've made a huge commitment to their staff. They've made a huge commitment to their surrounding staff. And then they've made a huge NIL commitment. And the thing that people have to understand is I'm very, very appreciative of what we've done here at Oklahoma State. Our administration is trying and doing everything they can to facilitate us in the NIL window.
Look, I'm very appreciative of what's going on. He must have got some blowback on his own campus at Oklahoma State from the fans there. He must have got some blowback as well, obviously publicly, from people saying, quit crying about money. You had T. Boone Pickens. You invented this game at Oklahoma State. Oregon's just playing it better now. It also looks like Okie State has a crowd following him this weekend. A Southwest Air charter left Stillwater about 1:30 today, headed for Eugene. Team is on the ground just about now. They just landed in Eugene. So Oklahoma State in Eugene now as a program, and the booster's not far behind. But we're going to talk about Mike Gundy. Was it poor form? Were his comments about resources this week, was he right? Was he wrong? Was he wise? Was he foolish? The jurors will kick that around at 4 o'clock. You're invited to participate in that as well. I sort of look at what Gundy did, and I think, okay, yeah, there's truth in what he's doing. But would it have served him better to say it after the game, or is he trying to soften the blow because they're going to get boat raced on Saturday against Oregon? Just something to think about. We'll talk about it coming up. Stephen Vaughn, you're in studio. We got a short show today because we have a big, Friday night game in the NFL. Where are we going? We're going to Spain? Is that where
we're going to Brazil.
We're going to Brazil for a football game. How do you feel about these games in other countries? How do you feel about the spitting on Thursday night? Big storyline.
Yeah, first of all, location of the games. I don't have a problem necessarily with the NFL going to different countries to play the games. I do think it is it's a disadvantage for sure. What I do have a problem with is that they're going to have a big division game in Brazil. Like, I get wanting to go to week one and having that game, but does it really have to be a Chiefs-Chargers division game where both these teams definitely are looking forward to making the playoffs? Like, this could have a real effect on the season, and is counted as a division game. One team is losing a home game by having this in division. I don't like that. I don't mind when they play overseas, but don't make it like a big division game. The people in Brazil, probably no offense to them, they don't care if there's going to be a big division game or if it's, the Broncos versus the Jaguars. Like, they're going to be happy that they get the NFL there. They don't need to get one of these big-time, prime-time division games, in my opinion. That's my only problem with it. And then the spitting part, I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy that people go to that level, because there's a couple things that really bother me in sports. Spitting would be one. Like, if I got spit on, those are fighting. That's a fight, like, ready to happen. And I'm just speaking, for basketball terms. Also, when people tell me to shut up, that is really, like, irritating to me. So, like, spitting and someone telling me to shut up is kind of the same. It's just disrespectful is what it is. And so I take disrespect as I'm going to fight you because you don't respect me. So, I mean, it's just crazy that Jalen Carter took it to that level. I know he was excited for the game, all that kind of stuff. But, man, you have to have some type of composure. And that is just not the way to go about it. I think being kicked out of the game is fine. I don't think you should be suspended or anything like that. But I think it's just so disrespectful, and you're just looking down upon everybody when you do that.
And selfish, too. You're ejected 6 seconds into the game, and you're a key player in the game. Like, the banner gets raised, the Super Bowl championship thing, and the game kicks off, and then Jalen Carter's ejected 6 seconds into the game. He walks over to the huddle. If you didn't see it, flag was thrown on the opening kickoff. Prescott approaches him. They exchange words. And then Carter's clearly seen spitting on Prescott, and the referees caught it and tossed him. And so Eagles go without one of their best players before they even got a snap. So it's not just disgusting, it's selfish. I mean, and to me, there's nothing worse than putting yourself in front of the team. There's no bigger sin here than Jalen Carter putting himself in front of the team. Now, the Eagles go on to win this game 24-20. That second half probably deserved to be spit on, if anything. There was 3 points scored in the second half of the football game. It's 21-20 at halftime. 24-20 is your final. But the Eagles end up 1-0, the Cowboys 0-1, and the spitting thing takes center stage. And now, even as you go into the NFL Brazil game tonight, this Friday night game, you have this whole thing with the NFL and spitting hanging overhead and a whole bunch of questions about, what will the punishment be for Jalen Carter despite getting ejected? And you have, by the way, you have this precedent set just today as Luis Suarez, who is a striker for the for Inter Miami, gets a 6-game suspension by the League's Cup for spitting at a Seattle Sounders staff member after Sunday's League Cup final. Sounders won 3-0. Brawl broke out before the final whistle. Suarez had to be held back by his teammates and coaches before he spat on a member of the opposing team's staff. And so there was a punch thrown. There was some aggressive behavior here and there. And the spitting seems to be the biggest offense, bigger than you could throw a punch. Would you, like, you think it's poorer form to spit than throw a punch?
100%. Yeah. I would rather have a punch thrown at me than someone spit on me.
Well, there you go. Don't spit at Steven. We have a great show otherwise. We've got Punch It Audio coming up. We've got great sound. Of course, the NFL will dominate the Punch It Audio coming up later. But Nick Saban speaking out, is he talking different than Mike Gundy here? Maybe or maybe not. Former Alabama coach talking about the Big Ten and what an advantage the Big Ten conference teams have.
I think that the SEC was the SEC because of the culture in the South there wasn't professional football in the South for a long time, and everybody related to the colleges. Okay, we talked about that before. Well, now that doesn't matter. I mean, kids grew up wanting to go to LSU. Kids grew up wanting to go to Alabama. Kids grew up wanting to go to Georgia. Got the money now. They don't mind going to Ohio State. They don't mind going to other places. So that geographic advantage that the Southeast Conference had may be
changing
a little bit.
Yikes.
Now with a different culture, with name, image, and likeness, and money involved in decision-making. And I think that's created a little bit of an edge for the Big Ten.
All right. It's one thing for Nick Saban to say it. It's different for Gundy to say it. We're going to kick it around with the jurors later to talk about that. But Saban is saying there's an advantage in the Big Ten. I can't help but think, Stephen, that Nick Saban knew this when he walked away at Alabama, and that Kalen DeBoer is going, yeah, I feel you, because no longer does Alabama have this, hey, we've got the best roster, the Big Ten teams can't match it. Suddenly there's this rise of power in the Big Ten Conference with the TV money involved and the revenue share, the ability to revenue share, and large alumni bases. So you have these powerful NIL collectives at places like Ohio State and Penn State. And Oregon, obviously funded by Phil Knight, that don't exist in the SEC. Now, I do think the SEC schools like Georgia and Alabama and whatever, you know, they've got rabid fan bases, big stadiums, but they don't quite have the TV deal that the Big Ten Conference has. And I think over time, they're going to find themselves at a little bit of a financial disadvantage. Poor form by Saban to point this out, or where does your mind go? Because my mind goes like, hey, no wonder he walked away.
God, poor Nick Saban, John. It's so unfair now that the SEC can't compete with the Big Ten because they don't have. I mean, give me a break, man. Like, you're acting like you're all high and mighty. You weren't doing shady things in Alabama. You guys were by the book. They never broke any type of rules ever. I mean, come on, man. Nick Saban, man, sometimes the stuff he says, it just bothers me so much. I get it. The SEC is so much better than everybody else. I actually think they're the best conference in America. But you know what? Now that there's money involved, other teams and other conferences are catching up, and he can't deal with it. And you're right. That's why he left. Like, don't kid yourself. That's why he decided not to coach at Alabama anymore. He didn't want to deal with this. He was already seeing it happen. He was seeing players leave in the portal, and he wasn't getting every single top guy like he had. He wasn't having first-round draft picks as the third stringers, so you could have two injuries and you'd still be okay. He wasn't having that anymore, and he couldn't deal with it. And so, I don't know. That comment just was so bothersome to me. Like, oh, man, these guys, they'll finally go to Ohio State now, acting like Ohio State wasn't good before this. Come on, Nick Saban. Give me a break right this.
But I think there's truth in what he's saying. And also, I find it interesting that the schools that once were the haves are now whining. You know, like there's a hypocrisy there in the notion that, you know, hey, you had it better than anybody. And now you don't. Now it's time to whine about it and cry about it. Someday Oregon may find itself in that same position. But let's be real. Like, let's look around. Like, Oklahoma State is a great example with Mike Gundy. He had Team Boone Pickens, who, you know, gave this $165 million gift to the athletic department a few years ago. And at the time, it was a record-setting gift. Like, it was, use inflation all you want. But he was Phil Knight before Phil Knight. And, you know, Knight learned the game from T. Boone Pickens. And then you sort of look at what has happened in college athletics, and you have to ask yourself, like, oh, Is the SEC worried now about the Big Ten, and the Big Ten's going to run away with it all? Like, yeah, I think they are. They seem to be pointing that direction. And the last two national champions come out of that conference. If that trend continues, it starts to erode, you know, everything that the SEC did over 10 or 12 years. They were still the best conference in all of football. And I think over the last 15 years, you look at it and you go, oh, they dominated. But the trend recently has been for these Big Ten teams to kind of make hay while they can. And I do wonder what happens. And when you talk about football splitting away, or you talk about the ability for, football to split away, look out. All right, Stu Jackson's coming up. WCC commissioner will be with us. We'll also talk to the BFT jury at 4 o'clock. Stick around. You got the bald-faced truth statewide on the BFT radio network. Hey, it's Canzano for the team at Gresham Ford. Bess Wills and her son Preston do a fantastic job of setting culture. Good culture at Gresham Ford. They have a great Ford vehicles, new and pre-owned. They do a great job with, taking care of their customers. And they want you, when you're on the car lot, to walk off the car lot feeling like, hey, I got a great vehicle. I feel good about it. And best of all, I feel great about the transaction I just had. Gresham Ford can do that for you. They've done it for a whole bunch of other people and a lot of BFT listeners. Go online to GreshamFord.com. You can see their full line of vehicles from the pickup trucks to the SUVs and back. Gresham Ford, they are the dealer with a heart. They take care of their community. Bess and Preston have long supported the local food bank, local schools, sports organizations, and a whole bunch more. Go in, see them on Powell Boulevard, test drive a car, tell them I sent you out. Gresham Ford, they'll take care of you. They are the dealer with a heart.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, the WCC made some news this week. They are expanding, or they already expanded, I guess. They announced it. WCC adding UC San Diego to begin play in 2027. Here to talk about it, WCC Commissioner Stu Jackson. How you doing, Stu?
I'm doing well, John. How about yourself?
Big week for you guys, adding a school. What's that feel like?
No, it feels good. You know, we were in a position, John, as I've, you know, told most of the listeners before when I've had the fortunate chance to be on your show previously, that, you know, this current season, you know, we're going to be at 12 members. That's 10 full-time members, along with the two affiliates, Oregon State and Washington State, in 12 sports. Next year, you know, Gonzaga will be leaving as a full-time member, which will take, as well as Oregon State and Washington State, which takes us down to 9 members. Nine's not a good number, so at some point we needed to add a 10th member to the conference, and we are extremely pleased to be adding UC San Diego beginning competition in the 2027-28 season.
Why UC San Diego? Why did they fit in your mind?
For a number of reasons, John. This, you know, their leadership at UC San Diego is very committed athletically. You know, they've only been in Division One, I believe, a total of 5 years, and only eligible to participate in the basketball tournament last year. And that resulted in their men and their women both making it to the NCAA tournament in both sports, and that's the first time that that's ever happened in history, and they did it in their first year of eligibility. But more importantly than that, as an institution, academically, they're elite. Athletically, they're very committed and have exhibited a level of performance. Geographically, they fit with us. And, you know, UC San Diego, they put the student first, and student-athlete wellness is a key pillar for the West Coast Conference. So for all of those reasons I mentioned, we really feel like they are a tailored fit.
When you look at the WCC, or I think about the WCC, I think of faith-based schools. You know, this is a departure from that. Was that a difficult thing for the presidents and your board to embrace, or sign of the times, or, you know, where were their minds on that?
Yeah, it was not difficult for our president's council to embrace. I think there's an understanding amongst our president's council, and a credit to them, at the changing landscape of collegiate athletics, John. It's not like the old days, and we can't just simply align ourselves competitively with, you know, purely like schools. But so you have to pick your priorities. And, you know, our priorities are UC San Diego's priorities, and that is academics, athletic performance, certainly being in the footprint, so we're not going coast to coast, week to week, and a focus on the student-athlete wellness and experience. Those have to be the key criteria in this changing collegiate athletic landscape.
When I think about the future, I wonder about St. Mary's. They've been bantered about as a possible Pac-12 addition. Are you playing a little bit of defense with this, or where does your conversation with St. Mary's stand right now?
No, we're not going to play defense really against anyone. We're constantly going to try as a conference to be, you know, on the offensive, to remain innovative, to be nimble enough and hopefully smart enough to change with this landscape. But I will tell you, throughout it all, St. Mary's has been a very committed member to the West Coast Conference. John, listen, and I don't say that being naive. In today's landscape, every institution owes it to themselves to see what's out there, if there is an opportunity for realignment. And I'm not naive to think that, you know, some of our institutions in the West Coast Conference have made those calls. And it's a credit to our institutions that some other conferences would actually be interested in potentially aligning with them. All that being said, you know, St. Mary's has, at least in my mind, behaved like a member who's focused purely on the future of the West Coast Conference. And that goes from their leadership on down in trying to make this conference, one of the or the best mid-major conference in the country. And that's where they stand.
The landscape in general, you've talked often about, you know, protecting the NCAA tournament. You know, men's basketball becomes huge for your conference, given that there's no football played in it. Where does the WCC fit in the ecosystem in your mind?
You know, I believe that, you know, we are in a unique position. And from day one, John, I've really felt what is unique and special about this conference is the historical athletic performance in all of our sports, inclusive of basketball. And I'm speaking primarily of our Olympic sports. It makes us unique because we're able to compete on a national level. And when I say compete, I'm talking multiple bids in many of those sports, like men's golf, women's soccer, men's soccer, beach volleyball, men's and women's tennis. And you couple that with the performance in, men's and women's basketball, and where we fit, you know, we fit smack dab in the middle. And when I say in the middle, with the upper echelon being those Power Four football conferences, and in basketball, add to that the Big East. But then after that, you know, that's where our space is, and we are going to continue to aspire to be an elite mid-major conference.
Do you have concerns about the Power Four trying to take the NCAA tournament and turn it into something that maybe it's not designed to be?
It's a little bit of a trick question, John, because I don't know what the NCAA tournament is really designed to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, the history of the NCAA tournament is that it has always evolved in terms of the number of teams, the structure of the bracket, and certainly the number of eyeballs that, are on this tournament. It's evolved. So I don't know what the right model looks like. Mm-hmm. But that being said, you know, the Power Four football conferences, I think for conferences like ours, we understand that their goals, their issues, they're different from ours. And we recognize that. And one of their issues is they really feel like they drive much of the brand in college athletics. Now, I don't necessarily happen to agree with that wholeheartedly, but they also feel that, you know, by having different issues, feeling that they drive brand and they invest more monetarily, that they should have more access to championships. And I hear you. You know, I understand the logic. I don't necessarily agree with that because, John, if that were true, you know, the biggest spenders should have the most access, drive the success. I mean, the Yankees would be in the World Series every year, but they're not, particularly in the sport of basketball where, as we know, you've got five-man teams, and if you manage your program correctly, you do a good job of player development, you have an adequate level of revenue sharing, you know, you get lucky, and you can compete with really anyone. So all we want as mid-major conferences, though, is access to that tournament. I don't know what the structure is going to look like. You know, it may expand. It may not. But as long as we have access, and financially, we're not disadvantaged in terms of revenue sharing from the NCAA to conferences like ours. Hey, Power Four, have at it.
Stu Jackson with us, WCC commissioner. Will there be further additions, or is this just a, hey, you're making this move and sitting tight for a bit?
Well, again, going back to one of your other questions, we're going to be on the offensive, John. Our president, about a year and a half ago, committed that when we were also at 9 members at that time, they committed that we wanted to add 1 to 3 more members to the WCC. In their minds, that was optimal. And we'll continue to, pursue that.
Stu Jackson, college football is going on, but basketball is not far away. What can you do as a conference to try to create additional revenue? We see Oregon and Gonzaga coming up with a early season game and our game in December that they'll get the bulk of the profits from. Is this kind of the future model for some non-conference matchups?
I do think it is, part of the model, John. And, for conferences like ours, I think it's really important that we try as best we can to create more premium level matchups against not only Power Four schools, but even strong mid-major schools in an effort to obviously generate revenue, generate interest, but to also bolster, our metrics. Because at the end of the day, you're going to have success in the NCAA tournament if you not only qualify, but you qualify with a resume and metrics that allow you to improve your seeding. And for us as mid-major conferences to survive, I think you have to, think that way.
Stu Jackson, congrats. You got a new school in your stable. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, anytime, John. Always enjoy it.
There he is, former Kamikaze kid, Stu Jackson. Now the commissioner of the WCC. They've got UC San Diego in the fold. We've got Punch It Audio coming up. The best sound from all around. Stick around on this Friday.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Man, we had a good week with guests. Jimmy Rogers, Washington State coach, was on the show. Will Stein, Oregon offensive coordinator, was on the show. Trent Bray, Oregon State head coach, was on the show. Stu Jackson, you just heard him, the WCC commissioner, on the show. Trent Walker, wide receiver, Oregon State, on the show. The BFT jurors are coming up here in about 20 minutes, top of the hour. In the meantime, just know we get the big guest, and we're going to play some Punch It Audio. Let's do it.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters. Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio, presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Kyle Shanahan, 49ers coach, asked about Christian McCaffrey's status Sunday night.
It's questionable. Questionable concern. I'm not going to say anything about Christian Gus or any of our players' injuries.
Did not practice. Questionable for Sunday. Running back Christian McCaffrey, if he's not in the lineup week one, yes, less than a surprise than it did last year, but still a big blow for the 49ers. Listed as questionable because of the calf injury that caused him to miss practice today. Shanahan said this is landing him on the injury report as a limited participant, declined to forecast much more about his chances of playing this weekend. But if he can't go, it'll be Brian Robinson. It'll be Isaac Garrido for the 49ers in the backfield. That is not Christian McCaffrey. Big concern, Steven. No McCaffrey. So much a part of the 49ers' success over the last few years.
Yeah, nobody knows what to believe, because then Christian McCaffrey was asked about it, and he's like, that's what happens with injury reports. They come out and stuff like that. So, yeah, nobody knows. But I think you have to be concerned if you're a 49er fan, or if you're a fantasy fan, you got Christian McCaffrey, because, look, he was a hurt most of last season. Last year, remember, it was like an hour before the game. All of a sudden, he popped on the injury report, was going to miss week one. He didn't come back till like the middle of the season. Niners need that guy. He runs that offense, especially now with Brock Purdy as being the man. You don't have Debo. Juwan Jennings is banged up a little bit. You don't have the receiver help. They need that guy, and if he's out, I don't know. That's a tough ask to win up in Seattle week one.
49ers will need him in Seattle. Tom Pelissero says it's not time to sound the alarm on McCaffrey, but maybe get the alarm out.
Tabs can be tricky. Tabs can be precursors to Achilles injuries. McCaffrey had issues with both his Achilles last year. There's a lot of reasons to be cautious about saying anything at this stage. He was undergoing tests today. They're on the field in 90 minutes or so. You know, the real question, at least short term, is even if it is something that's a precaution, even if they think it's minor, do they risk running him out there in week one and suffering the type of setback that could take him out for a month? All those questions will start to get answered this afternoon. Again, from my understanding, I do not believe that this is, you know, the full alert, the alarms going off on Christian McCaffrey, but definitely something to keep an eye on.
Definitely keep an eye on it, but if you're a Niner fan, and I am, you got to be worried. Huge opportunity for John Mateer, Oklahoma playing Michigan on Saturday. Todd McShay says it's John Mateer's day.
If Oklahoma wins on Saturday night, John Mateer is the story in college football. He will have taken over September in college football. Everything with this guy is a fire drill. John Mateer gives zero f**ks. He doesn't care.
No.
He will challenge you on all three levels. He has an unbelievably quick release. The ball just snaps off his hand. He's got full back legs, and he's the most competitive SOB, maybe in college football.
Competitive guy. We watched him at Washington State. Not hard to see Mateer as a Heisman finalist, but here it is. Here comes that big coming out game where the rest of America gets to meet him. Every Heisman Trophy winner, every Heisman Trophy finalist has this kind of game in this moment. You can see it coming for Mateer. It's an opportunity for exposure. Will he seize the stage or not? We'll find out. Moving on, Dave Portnoy with Fox says, I'm smarter than everyone else.
I think I'd be one of the great offensive minds in the history of the game. I honestly think play calling, I'm smarter than 99% of the play calls. I may not be X's and O's and pull guards and power trap and all
this. Well, see, that's opposing ideals, what you just said. You'd be one of the best play callers, but you don't understand pulling guards.
No.
He has Kadick for that.
Exactly.
I'm not doing the X's and O's of where the guards are. I'm saying, hey, it's third and seven, and I can tell the flow of this game, and I know they're going to blitz, and I know if we run a little draw play, it's going to pop for 10 yards. A lot of these guys have dumps in their pants calling plays. They're so nervous about screwing up. They don't think outside the box. And, like, how many times you sit there and you're like, what a stupid play call. How dumb are you? Why are you running the ball up the middle on third and two when they have 13 guys in the box? The play call, not the structure of, hey, the guard pulls here and does that. So it is a little subtle difference on, I said, I could do pass, run, where are we going? I think better than 99% of the play callers.
Portnoy, big fan of Portnoy. Look, he's really good at getting attention, at building pop culture media websites, at promoting his brand. He's done a nice job of all those things. This is just a continuation of that. He is Fox's version of Pat McAfee. Not for everyone, but the bros love him. Dak Prescott, meanwhile, talking about what happened with Jalen Carter. He got spit on by Carter. Carter rejected 6 seconds into the Thursday night football game.
I probably spit 1,000 times throughout the game. I mean, especially game day, maybe even in general, and something I guess I'm not proud of. But in that case, he was trolling, I guess you could say, trying to mess with Tyler Booker. I was just looking at him. I was right here by the two linemen, and guess I needed to spit, and I wasn't going to spit on my lineman, and I just spit ahead. But I'd say he was back there where Jory was in that sense, and he asked, or he goes, you trying to spit on me? And at that point, I mean, I felt like he was insulting me. Like, I wouldn't spit on somebody. I'm damn sure not trying to spit on you. Like, we're about to play a game. I'm wondering why you're trying to mess with the rookie. And so when I stepped through, I actually say the words, like, what the hell would I, excuse me, but I'm probably even more colorful. What would I need to spit on you for? And he just spit on me in that moment. And it was more of a surprise than anything. Refs obviously saw it through the flag. I was like, hell yeah, we get 15 yards to start the game off. Didn't realize he was getting ejected. Unfortunate that he did. Hell of a player.
Hell of a player. Didn't play for his team. Only 6 seconds into the game. We'll see what the NFL does. He's ejected. Jalen Carter's not there. Eagles still win it 24-20. First football game of the season. Meanwhile, Steve Ballmer, owner of the Clippers, he's been in the middle of this "did he pay extra to Kawhi Leonard" conversation. He says he was conned.
In the court documents and in Pablo's podcast, they report it was $28 million.
Pablo's podcast, I don't know anything about the court documents on this. I haven't seen them, and I don't know. I'm not trying to be, ooh, I don't know. I really don't know. But the speculation is what it is. And why did they do that?
It's a lot of money. I mean, $28 million, $7 million a year is a lot of money for a guy that you didn't actually require to do anything.
I don't know why they did what they did, and I don't know how different it is. I really don't. And frankly, any speculation would be crazy. These were guys who committed fraud. How would I be able to? Look, they conned me.
You're one of the richest men in America.
They conned me. I made an investment in these guys thinking it was on the up and up, and they conned me. At this stage, I have no ability to predict why they might have done anything they did.
Clippers owner there, Steve Ballmer, says he would welcome the NBA taking a closer look if another franchise was accused of attempting to circumvent the league's salary cap. Said he'd want the league to take it seriously. Says it's important to the league. He'd want them to investigate. NBA confirms that a probe is underway. The league looking into this. Ballmer says he's embarrassed and has experienced sadness amid the fallout. Pablo Torres, the reporter, podcaster, sports media personality who broke the story, Ballmer saying, quote, "We did things by the book." How big of a story is this in the NBA, Stephen?
I think it's huge if it comes out that Ballmer knew about it. Now, if Ballmer's telling the truth and he really got conned, I don't think it's much of a story. But if Ballmer knowingly avoided the salary cap and paid Kawhi Leonard this type of money for a no-show job and gave him that extra money, I think it's huge. And I think that it could... I don't know if it's going to take Steve Ballmer down, like, as an owner of the LA Clippers, but I think there's a lot of punishment on his way, and I think that it would open up a whole Pandora's box for other owners to say, look, make sure you got everything on the up and up here, guys, because this one got caught, and make sure you invest money in people that you trust, because I'm assuming Ballmer's not the only person that's done something like this. So I think every other owner is watching this saying, look, man, hey, going to their accounting guys saying, we need to make sure we got all this on the up and up just in case people start, poking around in what we're doing here. So I think it could have huge ramifications if it comes out Ballmer knew that this is what the money was for.
We don't trust uber wealthy people. We don't. And so I think there's an element of that to this Ballmer story. And, when people looking at the, American millionaires and billionaires and believing that people don't build wealth without skirting rules, and he has real wealth. And so billionaire wealth, we watch billionaires exploit systems, find leverage that others don't have available to them. So I think there's a lot of mistrust in this.
Do you think it's weird that he went on ESPN and SportsCenter to make this claim when he could have just gone on Pablo Torre's podcast and talked to Pablo about it, who broke this story? Like, Torre just had Mark Cuban on to talk about it for over an hour. Why didn't Ballmer just do the same thing? Like, that was a little fishy to me that he goes on ESPN to do that rather than to talk to the actual guy that broke the story.
Yeah, because he's going to get a favorable ride from ESPN. Why? Because ESPN is in partnership with the NBA. So he's going to get a cleaner, easier ride.
That makes me think he's guilty a little bit more.
Yeah, it makes ESPN look bad, too. Like, why, they look like they are the shill here. Chris Mannix says the Clippers could get the death penalty if this is proven to be true.
If it's discovered, and again, it's a big if here, but if it's discovered that they circumvented the cap, I don't think that Silver is going to have any choice but to administer the kind of punishment that David Stern administered 25 years ago to the Minnesota Timberwolves and Joe Smith. If Adam Silver is going to use that as the standard for punishment for cap circumvention, then this is a basketball death penalty that he could potentially levy on the LA Clippers.
Basketball death penalty. We'll see how far it goes. I mean, it does matter. What did Ballmer know? What can they prove that he knew? And how far that will go to telling this story. I think it's a big story. Meanwhile, Michael Wilbon says the media needs to stop exaggerating everything. Here's Wilbon. I love this.
Here's what stood out to me week one and all the days leading up to week one. I don't want mass media, major media networks, including people that we like to call our friends, to just ruin the watching of college football for me, the consumption of college football, by exaggerating the hell out of everything, by overstating everything. Arch Manning is not Peyton or Eli or Archie just yet. Yeah. Just let him simmer a little bit.
Let it percolate.
Let it Jeremiah happen. Smith. He is not Jerry Rice just yet. I heard somebody who I probably like a lot say, probably somebody I covered, say he's the best college football player I've ever seen. You know what my recommendation would be? Then watch more college football over the last 50 years, because he ain't the best I've seen. He's made some great catches and things that make you go, woo. But can we just stop?
Michael Wilbon saying this on the four-letter network. Stephen, I find that to be interesting. Like, point the finger at your own employer.
I find it great. I think it's great because he is 100% right, John. We talked about it all week, like leading into week one. Like, why are we keep hearing about Arch Manning being, you know, this generational quarterback that's going to, you know, break everything? Well, then he comes out and scores 7 points against Ohio State. Like, let him play a little bit before we anoint them as the best ever. Not everything is the best ever. Not everything's the worst ever. There's a little bit in between. Just because someone ranks you as the fifth best player in the league doesn't mean you're bad. Like, everyone goes 100 or zero, nothing in between. I'm with Wilbon on this one. I think ESPN is the worst of the worst, and he's a part of that company. He just called everybody out and said, look, college football, you need to do better. Like, we need to stop acting like these guys are the best players of all time when they have not proven anything.
I'll tell you what happens, and I can speak to this from, you know, experience in being in on a production meeting on the Fox Sports Studios on the Fox lot. It was a few summers ago. They invited a bunch of radio people in. They said, hey, you're going to be part of these panel discussions. I was in those production meetings, and you could just feel the producers and the associate producers and the interns hunting for what's going to go viral and what, you know, they're not really actually talking about what's going on. They're looking for hot topics that are lightning rod topics that they can put out there that are going to drive ratings and drive interest. It's not, to me, it's not the business we should be in, and it's disingenuous. And Fox is not alone. ESPN is not alone. A lot of media outlets and entities, radio stations, newspapers, all do it. There's a reason why your state newspaper of record in this state, you know, at the end of every year, they give us an evaluation. Here's how many page views you got. We weren't talking about the quality of your work. They were talking about how many eyeballs you can get, more outlandish headlines, get more eyeballs. Everybody driving the same narrative. The BFT jury's coming up. Stick around for it.
BFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, it's a Friday. You know what that means. It's BFT jury day. The jurors are in the deliberation room. Steven, you're going to join the jury as well. John Strong, voice of American soccer, lead play-by-play voice on soccer for Fox, is with us. Michael Llewellyn, longtime sports executive, Nike, in the entertainment world, in media, at the collegiate level, Trailblazers VP. Michael Llewellyn, part of the jury. We're going to talk about a couple of different topics here. First and foremost, where are we on spitting? I'm not a big spitter. I have seen people that are spitters in public.
Were you a spitter when you played baseball?
No, was never a big spitter. Keep my saliva to myself. Jalen Carter didn't. He spat at Dak Prescott last night and got ejected in the Thursday night game. And Luis Suarez was hit with a lengthy Leagues Cup ban for spitting on a Sounders staffer. What should the punishment be for spitting? Can you reasonably enforce spitting? Was there a second spitter? Jerry Seinfeld once upon a time asked. Will we have to go to replay on spitting? Secondarily, I want to talk about Mike Gundy's comments this week about his lack of resources at Oklahoma State. He's at a Power Four conference school, one that had a booster and a donor named T. Boone Pickens, who gave hundreds of millions of dollars to the university, $650 million he gave to Oklahoma State. Was Mike Gundy right or wrong to talk about the disparity in resources between Oklahoma State and Oregon? Is it poor form or not? Was he wise? Was he foolish to make this a talking point on This Week? Those two things are the subject of the BFT jury.
Spanning the city in search of sports fans willing to explore the constant variety of sport and opinion. These sports freaks are prepared to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the bald-faced truth.
He's asking you if you'll swear to tell the truth.
This isn't 12 angry men stuck in a jury room. It's Boulder.
Kindly address this court as your honor.
Welcome, the Bald-Faced Truth Jury.
Well, we're in the deliberation room. Michael Llewellyn's going to lead us off. Michael Llewellyn, welcome. The spitting incident on Thursday Night Football and another spitting incident in soccer, top of my mind today. Where are we on the idea of players spitting at each other on the field?
John, aside from the unsanitary part of it, I mean, I think there's few universal gestures of disrespect like spitting. And the way it happened last night, I know Jalen Carter, the referee was literally standing right there. And, you know, some thought that he may have been retaliating to what he thought was something that that Dak Prescott had done. You know, the last guy into the pile usually is the one who gets the flag first. You know, it's never the lie, it's the cover up that gets you in the most trouble, but that's as bad as it gets. And that's a reason to as Jim Rome would say, throw hands. And even if he felt he was disrespected and thought he needed to respond, to Dak Prescott, if he shoves him, you know, maybe he gets, a personal foul penalty, gets a quick 15 yards, but he's still in the game. For him to get, disqualified, I think that was certainly the right penalization. I'm sure he'll be fined, by the NFL. And if as the NFL is going over the rest of the film, if it looks like they think Dak Prescott may have provoked him, then there might be a fine where that's concerned. Then, of course, the penalty in soccer was certainly warranted because, again, it serves the same purpose. There's almost nothing more disrespectful than you can do as a universal sign of respect and ugliness than spitting on somebody.
Michael Llewellyn, well put. John Strong, voice of American soccer. John Strong, Luis Suarez getting six games. Jalen Carter daring the NFL to suspend him. Where do you stand on all this stuff?
So wait, first of all, if Burnback is still on strike, am I like crossing a picket line? Like, is this poor form of mine to be doing this right now, or like what?
He's not striking against this show, so you're not like a scab who's crossing the line.
I just want to be sure. Okay. I don't want to be disrespectful.
He's working in a job where he's got to deal with people who are striking. So that's what he's doing.
I just want to make sure he's not getting forgotten, getting wallet-tipped here.
Yeah, you got him.
Or something like that.
I'm sure he's listening.
Yeah, so there's a couple things with this. So I was at the game on Sunday, up in Seattle when Luis Suarez, I mean, the completely ridiculous histrionics from these supposed great champions of Inter Miami, Sergio Busquets and Luis Suarez and others, Messi stayed out of it. It makes me very angry, first of all, because what we're not talking about is the fact that they sold 70,000 tickets in 3 days, mostly to fans who were there to support the Sounders, not Messi fans. We're not talking about really a remarkable upset that a team mostly made up of guys that are from the Seattle area beat a Miami team that has Messi and Suarez and Busquets. Mm. This is also very different than what happened last night. So what happened last night is, Dak Prescott, you know, jawing at an opponent. They come face to face. These are two competitors. These are two athletes. Prescott spits in one direction, you know, and it kind of et cetera, et cetera. This is post-game. This is when Miami have been soundly beaten. Luis Suarez is squaring up with a guy named Gene Fernandez. This is Gene. I've known Gene for a long time. He's acted as an interpreter for us a lot of times for Spanish-speaking players. He's the director of security for the Sounders, but he's an incredible human being. He's a great guy. He's not being aggressive. He's not being confrontational. He's doing his job as director of security of trying to step in between Luis Suarez and a teenager, Obed Vargas, who was getting in his face. And what Suarez does is he stands on Gene's foot so that Gene can't walk away, and then he spits in his face. And unlike Dak Prescott, there's no helmets, there's no pads. The other problem is And I will try to be politically correct and choose my words carefully here. This announcement, which is put out Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern time, gets the headlines I think the league wanted. Six-game suspension. Here's the problem. It's not really actually a six-game suspension. It's a suspension for the League's Cup, which is a separate mid-season tournament that has been created the last couple of years in partnership between MLS and the Mexican League. Luis Suarez is not, as it stands, suspended for any actual real MLS games. And there's no guarantee he's even going to be on the team next year after the World Cup. So this might be a completely irrelevant gesture. And while the league has said they reserve the right to issue a further suspension, I would be genuinely surprised if that happens. I don't like this at all. Even if it means that I don't know what it is to be a high-level athlete, I've never been in a scenario myself where I felt the need to assert or defend my masculinity to another man by spitting on him. I would be more than happy to never see Luis Suarez play for Inter Miami again. It's not something that needs to be in any way tolerated, least of all because whether we say this all the time over the years, whether these guys understand this or not or are comfortable with this or not, they are all role models. I see all the time on youth soccer fields the ways that kids are emulating what they see, good and bad, from pro athletes. This needs to be made exceptionally clear that this is sort of beyond the pale, particularly given the context of who he was doing it to, why he was doing it, and when he was doing it. So in my mind, for Luis Suarez in particular, there is no suspension too big. What am I expecting from the NFL? Maybe they tack on an extra game. Maybe they want to set an example. Maybe not. I'm not quite sure. The NFL tends to play by their own rules. But the thing with Suarez makes me absolutely furious.
I am looking at, you know, the suspensions. What do you think the NFL does with Jalen Carter? Is there we need to send a message in the Jalen Carter thing? Or do you look at what happened in soccer as a completely different, because of what you pointed out, completely different circumstance?
I think the circumstances are different on their own. Like, the context is very different, let alone, you know, the amount of games in the NFL season as compared to the MLS season and things like that. What's always interesting to me in situations like this is that, generally speaking, it's the job of a players' association to appeal and try to reduce suspensions or fines that are levied out on their players. It's always interesting to me when the injured party is a fellow player. And I would be curious what other NFL players and what Eagles teammates think. Like, do they want the book thrown at them or not? Or would they say, hey, it was heat of the moment, it happened, you know, being ejected for the entire rest of the game, getting, you know, one game suspension for that, you know, that's more than plenty when you consider it. But I do think it's important for sports leagues to be able to send clear messages. And maybe sometimes a fine is more impactful. I don't know. That there are, and how do we count it? I mean, is spitting on a guy better or worse than using a racial slur? Is it better or worse than, you know, causing a severe injury with a dangerous tackle? You know, it's always interesting to me when sports leagues or commissioners have to define how bad a particular action is. But it does seem to me most people seem to be in agreement that spitting on another person, that's one of those things that really crosses the line in a really severe way.
John Strong, voice of American soccer, Fox Sports, lead play-by-play broadcaster in that sport. Stephen Vaughn, you're on the jury as well, replacing Craig Burnback. You already said that's fighting for you, but does the league need to send a message here with an especially harsh punishment for Jalen Carter, or where does this stand as a punitive action?
Yeah, I'm with Michael on this one. It is so disrespectful to spit on somebody. I don't think that the NFL needs to come down on Jalen Carter and suspend him for another game. I think that him missing the entire game and kind of getting made fun of and on prime time and by everybody is punishment enough for him. And to John Strong's point as well, the soccer incident's a little bit different than the competitors on the field. This is off the field, all that kind of stuff. So that is different, where he does deserve to be suspended more, and I'm with him. If he doesn't play anymore, that's great. But for Jalen Carter, John, I don't think that they need to come down on it, because this is caught up in the moment. It's week one. I do think if you go watch it, like, Dak did provoke him because he spit at him and looked right at him. Now, he wasn't spitting at him. He didn't spit on him. But it was, you could argue that, yeah, he might have made it at Jalen Carter. And so I don't think that anybody needs to be suspended. I think Jalen Carter's punishment was enough. But those are fighting words, and it's not really words, it's spit, but those are fighting spit words. If anyone's doing that at me, I'm coming at him. So I think Dak showed a lot of restraint by not doing anything, but I also think that has to do with maybe he provoked him a little bit and knew exactly what he was doing.
Michael Llewellyn, let me ask you, I mean, John Strong raised the point, like, you know, is spitting on someone something the league needs to come down on harsher than, you know, a dangerous play? Or, you know, where do you stand on that? You're somebody who's been involved in sports from the executive level.
Well, when you embarrass not only yourself, but you embarrass your franchise the way he did last night, it was the NFL season opener. So millions of eyeballs saw that. You know, there's a lot of, you know, punitive stuff that's already happening just in terms of the, you know, the impact on Jalen Carter's, you know, reputation. I'm sure that Nick Sirianni, the head coach, or maybe Jeffrey Lurie, the owner of the team, you know, maybe weighed in, you know, privately with him after the game. I'm sure there's some things that will happen, quote unquote, within the family. That will further underscore the message. You know, those of us here in the outside world in terms of fandom, you know, we don't know how much a player might lose unless it just gets publicized when he loses a game check, if he's suspended a game. The league does announce the fines. And so I think the notion of a fine would certainly send a signal across the entire league that this is not something to be tolerated. And I think it does, Landon. I think John hit it right on the head. It also is one of those things that does parallel what might happen with a racial slur. But I said it before, John, people, they're always watching. And you got a bazillion cameras, and if he thought he was going to get away with that in some way, shape, or form, I don't know what was going through Jalen Carter's head. But that kid's already paid a price last night, and his team paid a price. The only other place, I think, outside of things going bananas with the Players Association, is to hit him in the wallet. Same thing with Dak. If he provoked, then let's move on.
John Strong, I got you on here with Llewellyn and Steven. You're all in the same room together now. Give me an idea of, you know, a spitting incident during play, a spitting incident after play. It feels like that second one is a bigger offense in the world of soccer.
Well, and to Michael's point there, millions of people saw it. What matters most is the two eyes that saw it in the moment. Had the umpire not in that moment been stepping forward to get in between Carter and Prescott, then this is maybe a very different story. And maybe it's something the NBC cameras captured, but he plays the entire rest of the game. The fact that the official happened to be right there and happened to see it in the moment, and he got ejected and he ended up essentially suspended for the whole game, changes the dynamic significantly. I think, you know, in this post-game fracas, there was nothing obvious in the moment because I was there. I took my son and his two best friends. We were at the game. We could see the fracas going on. It was not until, and it was actually not even the main broadcast, it was Univision's broadcast that had a camera angle where they were able to show it. They rolled it back, and all of a sudden social media goes crazy with being able to see it. So the context is different and interesting, but I also think it would have been, had the official not seen the incident last night in the moment, had he played the entire rest of the game, even though we would have all known what had happened because it was pretty obvious from the video, I think that would have changed the story significantly as well. The fact that he got tossed before the first game. Now, of course, had the Cowboys actually won, then it really changes the story. At the end of the day, the Eagles are still 1-0, whether they win by 4 points or 40. But that was what was fascinating to me, is the fact that the official happened to see it at the moment.
What about Dak's, you know, Dak initiating this? Like, you know, some would argue he was smirking at Jalen Carter. He spit at his feet. You know, he didn't spit on him. But does Dak suffer a penalty here in the view of the NFL?
Perhaps. Certainly there's a phone call coming. But I also think, like, if you're Jalen Carter, you're playing for the Super Bowl champions against a middle-of-the-road Cowboys team. Why are you getting so fired up about Dak Prescott chirping at you before the first play of the game? Just go sack him. Like, that's the – whatever Dak did or didn't do, I think, is irrelevant. We all know it's always the retaliation that gets caught. It's always the retaliation that gets punished. But
Yeah, this is Dak just trying to rile up who he knows is the opposition's best player. And Jalen Carter falls for it hook, line, and sinker. Like, what are you doing, dude? Why are you even giving him the time of day with that when you are on the Philadelphia Eagles, who are the world champions?
I'm going to put you back on hold here. We're going to grab the second part of the BFT jury after the break. But quickly, Josh in Vancouver's called in. Josh, you want to weigh in as part of the jury? Go ahead.
Hey, John. Hey, yeah, I got to go with definitely, in my opinion, the Suarez thing is worse. And part of that is wrapped up in the history that the guy bit somebody 12 years ago, like in a game, in a World Cup, on the world's biggest stage. Like, he's got a super shady history. So, the Suarez thing to me, plus it wasn't in the heat of battle and the action and all that. Like, that's terrible. As far as spitting itself, it's vile, man. But I don't think it rises to like the level of like inappropriateness and like racial comments. Like, I don't know. I think that's a whole nother like level of inappropriateness. This is right below it. Still vile. You know, Dak should, he should get, if Jalen is going to get a punishment from the NFL, Dak should as well.
There you go. Okay. Josh in Vancouver saying that Dak should get a punishment. Steven, you agree with Josh or no? We're putting this to rest. You get the last word.
No, I think Jalen Carter gets the one game, or just misses like the one game from last night, doesn't get a suspension. I think Dak may get a fine because of the fact that he looked up after he spit. He looked right at Carter, started laughing. So I think that it could be maybe he provoked him.
You get
him.
A fine for spitting?
I mean,
you get a fine for laughing?
You could interpret that as provoking them. I think that could be very easily, and I don't think Dak would even care at that point. So
send them both to their rooms.
Yeah, but I think no suspension for Carter Suarez. You can do whatever you want with him. I think he should be done.
All right, we're going to talk about Mike Gundy, who caused a stir this week, early this week. He went on his coach's show on Monday, and he said he had some harsh things to say about, or maybe some true things to say, about the disparity in college football. The jurors are going to talk about whether it was wise for Gundy to bring this up in front of the game against Oregon. Maybe it was wise. We'll talk about it. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Mike Gundy talking about how Oregon spends this week.
You know, Oregon is paying a lot of money for their team.
Yep.
So from a non-conference standpoint, there's coaches saying they should play teams that are spending the same amount of money.
So what do you figure they are? Probably triple what you pay ballpark? Or do you
know? There's revenue sharing intact this year.
Yes. So that makes a difference.
Yeah, so some, but they haven't got their hands on it yet.
Gotcha.
So the last 3 years, you didn't have revenue sharing.
Right, right.
So, and it's funny you mentioned that, because I guessed that the last 3 years that we spent around $7 million over the 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Oregon spent close to 40 last year alone.
Wow. Wow.
So that was just 1 year.
Okay.
Now, I might be off a few million, but...
what's a few million among friends?
Well, what I'm saying is they're spending a lot of money. They spent a lot of money, you know, and there's some schools that are doing that.
Dan Lanning fired back in his Monday night news conference.
Like I said, I got a ton of respect for Coach Gundy. You know, ultimately, how blessed are we to be in a place that's invested in winning? If you want to be a top 10 team in college football, you better be invested in winning. And we spend to win. Some people save to have an excuse for why they don't, right? And ultimately, like, he's a great coach. They've done an unbelievable job. But I want to be a team that's competing at the highest level. And we're really fortunate to be in that situation. So I can't speak on their situation. I have no idea, you know, what they got in their pockets over there. I'm sure UT Martin maybe didn't have as much as them last week, and they played. So we'll let it play out.
Dan Lanning leaning into the idea that they've got resources. Gundy's comments, they made news, of course. Was he right? Was he wrong? Was he wise? Was he foolish to make this a talking point? Let's go to Michael Llewellyn on the BFT jury. Llewellyn, what do you say about Gundy?
Well, you know, based upon what the odds makers are saying about the spread for Oregon tomorrow, Gundy may have been plowing the road ahead of a beatdown, as he's expecting when he gets to Autzen Stadium. But, you know, all kidding aside, I think, though, there is some degree of truth in what he says, but I think I look at it from a bigger picture standpoint that, you know, the gap is widening between the haves and the have-nots. And that's the thing that I have feared since NIL really, you know, became what it became. When you started to look at the level of investment you were getting out of, you know, ultra wealthy, alums, you know, God bless Phil Knight, God bless T-Boone Pickens. And, you know, there are a few others that are out there, but that's a super short list of folks that are, you know, investing in their alma maters, you know, at that level. And it does create a difference. I think it really does. And it can be a painful difference, you know, when you like to think that you're on par with these programs and you might be on par with them at least somewhat when it comes to talent or you know, the you know, enrollment size or whatever the case might be. But money can be the differentiator, and clearly it is that now in intercollegiate athletics, and it's only going to get bigger.
There you go. Michael Llewellyn weighing in. Verdict on Gundy, wise or foolish? Sean Strong, is the timing of this make it wise or foolish? Is there truth in it? What's your verdict on Gundy?
Well, I find it deeply hilarious, all of it, because I'm old enough to remember, as you rightly pointed out, when Oklahoma State with T. Boone Pickens was one of the biggest spenders in college football. I'm also old enough to remember a time when the Oregon Ducks were desperate to be included in any sort of conversation nationally for college football. That now, a couple decades later, Oregon are the big bad bullies of this thing. I think it's wise from Mike Gundy. This is classic coach paving the road for if they get beaten up set tomorrow. Well, you know, what are we supposed to do? We're getting outspent. If they keep it closer, if they win, it just makes him look that much better. We've seen this a million times. If I'm Brett Yormark, by the way, the Big 12 commissioner, I don't love this because I'm trying to project an image nationally of we're the Big 12. We're a big time conference. And yet I have one of my really high profile programs crying poor ahead of a matchup with a Big Ten opponent, and not exactly an Ohio State or Michigan. So that's the other part of this that is a little bit, there's a paradox here to what Mike Gundy's doing. The point is valid in that it's one of the things the NFL does exceptionally well. They have competitive balance, they have parity. Every team financially starts from the same place. It is a contributing factor to the reason why the NFL is a behemoth. It is a concern, absolutely, about the future of college football, that the gap is widening. So while Gundy, I think, hits on a very fair point, which is that you have enormous discrepancies that, by the way, produce a lot of really boring games, including last weekend and probably tomorrow. I think it's also a bit lame and sour grapes preemptively from Mike Gundy, and bless Dan Lanning. I mean, what a great response. And like, yeah, really, were you worried about UT Martin last week, or are you just worried about yourself this week?
Yeah, there's great hypocrisy there. I hadn't thought about the Yormark part. That's a good point. What about the timing of it, Strong? Because I felt like Gundy was trying to prepare his fans for a beatdown. Like, hey, we're going to get beat, and it's going to be about resources. It's not about coaching. It's not about X's and O's. I didn't get outcoached. I got outspent. Is he wise to do this in front of the game? Should he have waited for after the game? He also poked the bear a little bit.
It's 1,000% what he's doing. Whether he's wise to do it now or later, I don't know. But I don't know if there's any good way for a Mike Gundy, for an Oklahoma State, to get beaten up, if indeed that's what even happens. We still got to play the game tomorrow. I mean, that's part of it. It's college football. Like, we'll see what happens tomorrow. But again, the fact that I think it's a very valid point that you raise. The fact that Gundy felt the need, as experienced a coach as he is at a high-profile program that he's at Oklahoma State, the fact that he felt the need on Monday of game week to start salting the water with this tells you something about how he views his team, about how he views his opponent this week, and about how he's looking out for himself and his perception that he's going to get from his donors and his boosters and the media afterwards.
Yeah, and I think that is a great point, the fact that he brought that up. Llewellyn, you're on as well. Any final thoughts on Mike Gundy? Was he wise or foolish to do this in front of the game? Why not wait till the post-game news conference?
the post-game news conference or his coach's show next week would have been a heck of a lot better, especially if he could. And let's say hypothetically it is a blowout tomorrow. Who knows if John hit it right on, you know, you got to play the game. But let's say it is a lopsided score tomorrow. Then, you know, you go to your post-game press conference or your coach's show next week or that next meeting with the, you know, the alumni and said, you know, this is what can happen when, you know, we're being, you know, outspent, you know, at such a level. So alumni and boosters and supporters of Oklahoma State football, Oklahoma State athletics, we're going to need you to dig a little deeper. And make no mistake, a lot of those conversations are already happening right now at programs of all sizes, you know, across the country as we see the economic dynamic really change, in especially with college football. So if he thought, you know, that this was something that would soften the blow, I think if he'd saved it for next week's coaching show, it might have been able to fire up a few of those Oklahoma State alumni.
Yeah, John Strong, let me ask you. I've got you on here with Michael Llewellyn. You're an alum of University of Oregon. It's not like they're saying, "Hey, we need money. We need money." All schools are saying that. But would that kind of plea from your football coach get you to go, "Hey, I better support the NIL collective"?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I view contributions to NIL collectives the way I view contributions to like political action committees. It's not something I would ever do, even if I agree with the cause. To me, where's that money really going? And I do know, you know, I think there are a lot of boosters, high-heeled, you know, well-heeled boosters who don't feel comfortable putting money directly into the pocket of teenage kids. And I think that's one of the challenges with the NIL fundraising, is you have a lot of people for whom they're just not even going to get involved in it. But yeah, listen, I mean, I was at the game. I took my son to that game too on Saturday. And I mean, that football facility, and they're building a new one, like the amount of spending and infrastructure is completely insane down there. And there are parts of me that feels a little bit uncomfortable with some of the directions of college football. There are parts of me that pragmatically is like, well, shoot, I'd rather be keeping up than falling behind. As I said, there's the other part of me, though, that remembers in the old days, even seeing an Oregon football score on the ticker on ESPN was an exciting thing. Hey, we're in the conversation. The fact that the Oregon football program is what it is now is quite remarkable. If you were to put a list together 40 years ago of the most high-profile college football programs and compare it to today, most of them would, in fact, be the same. Oregon is one of the very few that has been able to, yes, with Phil and Penny Knight and others, really pull themselves up a chair at the big boy table in college football. I think that's pretty darn cool. And so, yeah, are there parts of it that I don't love? Absolutely. Are there things with college football, I said this last week, I'm ambivalent about? 100%. But I also, you know, I'm old enough to appreciate how amazing it is that Oregon has got to this point that the Oklahoma State Cowboys are coming to Eugene being like, oh, man, how on earth are we going to deal with this game?
John Strong, Michael Llewellyn, thank you. Steven, your thoughts on Gundy's timing and his wisdom or lack thereof?
Yeah, I think if he does it after the game, it makes it sound like sour grapes and that he's making excuses of why they lost, which it goes back to when Oregon played Colorado and Coach Prime. Remember what he said after that game? Well, you better get me now, because that was what it kind of was. And it made it sound like, oh, okay, well, you know, it just sounded a little weird. I think it would be the same type of thing. Gundy goes out, loses by 30, and then says, well, they have more money than we do, so what am I going to do? I think this way, it's more like, look, when we get blown out by 30, this is why it's happening. And it's more foreshadowing it. And so I do think the timing is the right time to do it. I don't think doing it after the game does any help. I think this way it puts it out and, you know, and draws their attention, the fans, to it already. So I think it's good timing for Gundy to put it out there, because he knows what's going to happen. I know Michael and John want to be nice and give Oklahoma State a chance. They got no chance in this one.
Yeah, you still have to play the game, but nah. I agree with that. But I think Mike Gundy, I'm trying to figure out what his motivation was ultimately. Was it that he looked at this and said, there's no way we can beat these guys. We're going on the road. We are overmatched. Look at all the players they have. This could potentially be really ugly, like 50-10 ugly. And I better get in front of it and say it now so that when it's happening, everybody's, you know, again, this is a guy who took a reduction in his salary and his buyout in this last year at Oklahoma State, and kind of hat in hand returned his head as the head football coach. He also has like more than 100 more victories than the next winningest coach in Cowboys history. So it's, you know, he's a guy who I think is grappling with the stakes of where he is and also looking over going, I actually don't know if we can, I don't know if we can win this thing. So it matters to me, you know, does he think he can win and is just, or does he not? I kind of think he doesn't think he can win, Steven. I'm kind of with you on that one.
Yeah, I think he knows that they have no chance. Just watching the film, it's just like, man, we're going in with a backup quarterback, a redshirt freshman, and it's not going to be good. And I think he wants to get out in front of it. I don't want to. I think he wants to be proactive rather than reactive on this one.
There it is. And right, you, you know, he got beat at Oregon. I was in that postgame news conference at Oregon, where Coach Prime was like, and he also said, "I need 8 or 9 more dudes." You know, like I need, you know, I just need some more dudes, and. And you could clearly see that Oregon was playing for something extra in that Colorado game. And it, and I think it was as simple as, you know, that Dan Lanning and his coaching staff, who pride themselves on being great recruiters, were suddenly seeing another school that was doing it with a little bit of sizzle and a splash in recruiting and some hype. And I don't know. I want to bring our jurors back on for this one. John Strong, voice of American Soccer. Strong, do you remember when Coach Prime and Dan Lanning and Colorado, that Colorado game, there was something extra for Oregon in that game. I wonder if that extra will be here for Oklahoma State.
No, and that's actually what I've been thinking as you've been saying this. I think this is, is it Gundy's sort of self-preservation, a guy that already kind of came in on a little bit of thin ice this season? Yeah. But I think it's also him trying to motivate his team. And you know, everyone wants to be the underdog. Everyone wants to be the team that no one believes in. Everyone wants to be the team that's being disrespected. So I do think a lot of what Gundy's doing here is trying to flip the table a little bit, is trying to get his guys to really buy into the underdog. No one believes in us. We're outgunned. We're outmanned. No one gives us a chance. But these guys in, you know, us in this room, we're the only ones that believe in it. And so, you know, from that standpoint, if you're Dan Lanning, you do have to kind of parry it away publicly. And you also have to make sure that your guys are ready to go. And you understand that, that you are, you know, you're the hunted in this scenario. And so you have to make sure you start the game with the requisite amount of intensity. Thankfully, I think they did that really well against Montana State. That was actually something that impressed me with how they started the game Saturday. But I do see this as a motivational tactic from Gundy that he can use all through the week.
Michael Llewellyn, you remember the Colorado week. There was just a little extra juice there for Oregon.
You know what? Nothing fires up that locker room like, you know, it's us against the world. So that could be part of what he has in mind. But if you remember, too, going into that Colorado game, Lanning talked about, you know, those guys at Colorado out there for clicks. Mm-hmm. You remember that part of his pregame speech, letting him know that, hey, you know, they're out there for clicks. You know, we're in this thing to win. So I think that's part of the, you know, science and art form when it comes to coaching is what can you grab externally and internally and utilize it to, you know, to motivate your guys. Look, I've never seen a checkbook throw a block. I've never seen a bag of money catch a ball. So at the end of the day, you know, you got to do the blocking and tackling and play the game and see how this plays out. But motivation can go a long way, especially the underdog angle. So I think John's right on that, too, in terms of trying to get Oklahoma State geared up to come to Austin.
Yeah, there it is. Michael Llewellyn, John Strong, I appreciate your service on the BFT jury. Dan Lanning caught in that pregame talk, again, right before the Colorado game, where he was speaking, I think, candidly and passionately. It became a big talking point, like the next, because it was clear, like, Oregon has been accused of being this Paris Hilton-like rise of, you know, rise of excitement and flashy uniforms, and they're an outlier, and they're buying their way to the top, and look at them go. Oregon has been accused of that. And here came Colorado, doing some of the same talking, but Colorado had been there before, once upon a time. Now it was being fueled by Coach Prime. It was very interesting to hear, like, the public reaction to Dan Lanning in that pregame speech before the Colorado game.
Rooted in substance, not flash. Rooted in substance. Today, we talk with our pads. You talk with your helmet, right? Every moment. The Cinderella story is over, man, right? They're fighting for clicks. we're fighting for wins. There's a difference, right? There's a difference, right? This game ain't going to be played in Hollywood. It's going to be played on the grass, right? It's going to be played on the grass. And let's go.
We're about substance. They're about clicks. And you could hear the Washington fans and the USC fans and Oregon State fans going, what? What are you talking about?
Well, it did get posted right to social media afterwards.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That was
clicks.
It did get some clicks. All right. Leave it here. Some parting thoughts coming up. The 5 at 5. Can we squeeze it in? We'll see.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, we're off air early. We got about 9 minutes until we're off air here. We're going to jam in the 5 at 5. Stephen and I are going to do it. Let's see if we can do it.
The 5 at 5.
Here we go.
Number one.
Well, John, Caitlin Clark for the Indiana Fever is officially out for the rest of the 2025 WNBA season, meaning she will miss the final 3 regular season games and any potential postseason play. Clark has not played since July 15th due to a right groin injury. Now she's out officially for the season. Fever are the 8th seed in the WNBA playoffs. Noticeable is Clark didn't miss a game during her 4 seasons in Iowa or in her first season in the WNBA, but she said in a statement she's disappointed that she can't come back, but they need to focus on getting to the playoffs. Tough blow for the Fever, but I think tougher blow for the WNBA in general as they head to the playoffs.
Yeah, it's going to hurt TV ratings in the playoffs. Big draw, biggest draw in the league, biggest storyline of the league, and she's not available.
Number 2.
How about a little U.S. Open, John? That's been it's a great tennis tournament as we are now heading to the finals pretty soon as Carlos Alcaraz, he defeated Novak Djokovic in straight sets today at the U.S. Open in New York. He'll now take on the winner of between Yannick Sinner and Felix Auger-Aliassime. Now, Alcaraz, he's heading to his 7th Grand Slam final at the age of just 22 years old. Unbelievable. He's also the first man to reach the U.S. Open final without dropping a set, since Roger Federer did in 2015. And if he actually wins in straight sets, John, in the championship, he'll be the first person ever to, he'll be the first man ever to win every single match in straight sets without losing sets. So Alcaraz could set some history over the weekend in the championship.
Well, it'll give Carlos Alcaraz will give people a reason to tune in who might not normally be tuned into this kind of event. It's probably what tennis needed. Too strong as he gets to the final.
Number 3.
Well, Boise State is chalk them up as another school that's trying to get as much money as possible. As in partnership with Collect U, Boise State will be selling their blue turf. They've chopped it up since it's the authenticated 1986 blue turf, the original blue turf that they have. They will be making collectible shadow boxes worth $325. It'll be an authenticated swatch of the original turf from 1986, signed by former Boise State AD Gene Blymeyer, who also conceived the idea. But, Boise State trying to make as much money as possible. This is what you got to do. Sell the blue turf.
Jeremiah Dickey, the athletic director at Boise State, I went out there. I visited with him. One of the things he said to me in our sit-down interview was, hey, every dollar counts. They are trying to raise money. They are trying to stay on par with these other schools that they're competing against. And it was, not lost on me or anybody else that when Boise State made it to the college football playoff last year, their budget in football versus the other CFP teams was minuscule. I mean, you talk about, Boise State getting to the playoff. Their entire athletic department budget was a fraction of what Ohio State and Penn State and Oregon spend. Every dollar counts. Selling blue turf, it'll work for a while, but you'll fish that market out pretty quick. Those rabid Boise State fans will pony up, but then what?
Number 4.
Well, the Seahawks opened up their season against the 49ers on Sunday, and Seattle is doing something that they haven't done before. They say they will be sending in undercover law enforcement officers dressed in the opposing team's jerseys at Field this season in an effort to police illegal and unruly behavior. This will start in week 1 with the 49ers, but they'll do it throughout the entire 2025 season. Seahawks said the move was made to more quickly detect instances that could get out of hand. Officer and Lumen Field staff will intervene if they observe any certain behaviors, which range from not following instructions from stadium personnel to using offensive language and gestures. Now, they have talked about this exact strategy before of implementing it, but they just never have done it. They are now doing it for 2025. I think it, you know, now going against the Niners in the first game, that is, those fans seem to get crazy between the two. So hopefully there's nothing out of the ordinary there.
I like this. I like that, you know, it's like undercover boss, except, you know, they're going out to bust the unruly fans. I like this. Anything you can do to try to help avoid bad behavior at sporting events, I would be in favor of. Good on the NFL. Good on the Seahawks.
Number 5.
Well, Chiefs taking on the Chargers tonight in Brazil. It is the division game down there. I don't necessarily like that one. Chiefs 3-point favorites in this game. But John, this is the news that I can't believe. The NFL, they have a new protocol for international games this season, where now both teams will have their logos and colors represented, one in each end zone. So even though the Chargers are considered the, quote, home team, the Chiefs still have their logo and colors in the end zone. I don't like it. I don't like that at all. You know what? If you're going to say the Chargers are the home team, give them both end zones. This is a true neutral site game. Don't act like there's a home and road team. Just say neutral site. I don't like the fact that they're putting both in there.
Yeah, it's, it takes away the authenticity of this being, you know, it's a road game for one of these teams. And instead tries to make it, you know, let's make people feel more comfortable by putting, you know, the logo of the of their favorite team, the visiting team, out onto the field. No, I like that we know that we can tune into a game and we know immediately who the home team is, right? And we know who the road team is.
Even if it's in Brazil. Like, yeah. You know what? If the Chargers are the team, the Chargers are the team. Don't tell me it's the Chiefs and the Chargers. This isn't the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I get what they're trying to do, though. I mean, they're trying to make it more palatable for fans and more marketable. And, oh, it's a neutral site game, Steven, even though one of the teams is not the home team. I like the idea of there being a home team and a visiting team. So that's where we stand on that. All right, it's been a great week of radio. Will Stein was fantastic, Oregon offensive coordinator. Jimmy Rogers, the head coach at Washington State, was terrific as well. I thought those were the best two interviews of the week. Trent Bray at Oregon State came on, faced the music after losing. They get another opportunity this weekend to go out and try to beat a team that it's a must win for them. Stu Jackson, the WCC commissioner, with us today. Certainly Bruce Barnum comes on every week. We get great guests. Next week, we got Sean Lewis, the San Diego State coach, will be coming on early next week, I am told. Probably another Oregon assistant next week, as the Ducks are traveling on that Thursday, but might get another assistant coach from Oregon on early in the week. Dan Lanning's going to be on a plane on Thursday when we go to do that interview, so we'll see who falls out. But, Stephen, in the final minute of the show today, where do your eyes go this weekend? For me, I think Oregon's going to blow out Oklahoma State. I don't know what Oregon State's going to do. My eyes will be on the Beavers probably more than the Ducks, even though I will take in both games.
Yeah, I kind of think it's both the Pac-12 schools. As Washington State taking on San Diego State, you're having Sean Lewis on the next week. I think San Diego State is going to win this game, and then at that point, what do Washington State fans think, being 1-1 and having a close game against Idaho and then potentially losing to a San Diego State team, which has struggled the last couple of years? So I think those are the two in the Northwest that I'm really looking forward to. Like, must wins, I think, for all four of these teams, basically.
Must win situation. We'll see what happens. I appreciate everybody who makes this radio show part of their day. It certainly means a lot to me that you're here. You can grab a podcast wherever you get a podcast. I want you to be sure to tune in next week, as we're going to have great shows all week long. You can read me at johncanzano.com if you want your college football coverage for the weekend. I will be all over it. A very busy Saturday and Sunday. Big weekend in college football. Eager to see everything that happens. It sets up so nicely for week 3 next week. Stephen, I appreciate you. I appreciate all the interns and the production assistants who work on this show. And especially thankful for the listeners who are out there. I'm glad you're here. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time.